right, and welcome back to A Businessman's Guide to Almost Anything. Today with me, I'm sitting with Troy Luganbill again. Mm-hmm. Troy, why don't you introduce yourself and what you do?
Well, my name is Troy Luganbill. I am currently the manager at Village Books and Paper Dreams in Linden, previously the museum director and curator for the Linden Heritage Museum, and former, before that, bookseller at Little Professor Book Center in Gig Harbor.
Perfect. For those who have watched the previous episodes, we've talked a lot about history. We should talk a little bit about the bookstore now, at the very least. Yeah. So tell me, when you were leaving the museum, you joined the bookstore, and we've talked a little bit how it was partly out of your love for culture. Mm-hmm. Is that about right? So as you've come into this role of general manager for a retail for-profit industry, what have been some of the lessons that you've learned?
Going from a nonprofit, more, I guess, the academic aspect of a career into, as you said, more of a retail business aspect. One of the things that has surprised me is that all of the things that I was learning about in anthropology and early demographics and culture and things, when I was getting an associate or a bachelor's degree in anthropology and archaeology. The joke at that point in time was, as we had talked, is, well, if you can't get a job at a university, you could probably get a job in a marketing department somewhere for a corporation. Mm. I'm finding out, little did I know, how many anthropologists went out and found jobs in marketing and which really just absolutely blows me away. I had learned some of it at the museum, but in retail, it is factors of dozens beyond, and that is anthropology has studied culture and how people shop, how people get promoted to, how people experience their shopping. I mean, it's a science now.
Yeah.
It is an absolute science. It is not a hunch. It is not the old advertising agency where somebody's pitching an ad. Mm. Before going in and pitching the ad, the demographics have been crunched. The numbers are there. Retail is data-driven now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing how much of human behavior really can be quantified. I mean, if you want to go for the most intense marketing experience of your life, go to Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you sit down and realize Las Vegas is 100% marketed, mm-hmm. that experience is from the moment you see the idea of Las Vegas mm-hmm. to you leaving Las Vegas, somebody has determined and attempted to implement what your experience is going to be every step of the way.
I met a fella and he would build casinos. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of neat to meet someone who's in that kind of field. And he was telling me, you want to know how it is that they keep you in the casino and you're feeling great and you keep spending money? They take out the clocks? I don't know. It's because of the oxygen. Underneath the floor, they got vents that are pumping in pure oxygen, which is like effectively a high for us.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I feel great. I think I'm going to take the next role. I'm going to try again. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I never would have thought of that. Son of a gun. So all that to say is that we're in a digital age where we got Amazon and we got Kindle. How are you guys keeping your bookshop relevant?
The same way I think that every good retail and successful retail that is not dealing in basic consumer needs is. When I first started as a bookseller at the Little Professor Book Center, the concept of retail was figure out what people want and sell it to them. Mm. That it's all about the product. It's not about the product anymore. Mm. It's about the experience.
Yeah.
Retail therapy is an absolute real thing. Mm. And it amazes me how many people shop at the bookstore, at Cheeks Next Door, downtown Linden at the various places, downtown Bellingham, Seattle. I mean, they go there for the shopping experience of finding something that they feel they need, doing it in a pleasant environment, having fun and ideally connecting with somebody in the process of doing that. And whether that be a friend, whether it be the retail clerk, whether it be the person shopping next to you, but somehow making a contact, and that oddly enough, the thing which you've purchased is a memento of your experience retail shopping.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So, and books are fabulous because books are already an experience. And that is an experience which is, so you're seeing a pattern repeated at the end of a book. You've read through a book. You may not keep the book, but you keep the story, because the story, if it's a story you want to keep, that book is a memento of the experience of reading that story. It's physical proof to your brain that this actually happened. I read this story and it's cool.
It's almost like an achievement. And then we even put it on our walls and we show off that, hey, look at this book that I have.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, it's interesting to see that retail has now changed from it. I mean, it's a constant experiment in psychology, individual psychology.
I feel like there are certain, even restaurants, I've kind of moved in that direction, like Starbucks. The food's fine. The coffee's good. But when you're at Starbucks, you're kind of there because you need a place to chill out and to do some work. And Starbucks has got the place.
And they've very carefully made that determination of what that chill out is going to look like.
Yeah.
You have it on, you saw it back in the late 90s, early 2000s in some of the more cruder themed restaurants, but Rainforest Cafe.
Yeah.
You wanted to feel like you're eating outside in a rainforest? Go to the Rainforest Cafe.
Yeah. Is it authentic? No, but it feels like the rainforest. Exactly. Or how you think the rainforest should feel like.
Exactly. And and most importantly, in the process, you have fun. Mm-hmm. Because it's different, it's new, it's a story you can share. And the one thing that I learned working at bookstores, getting an anthropology degree, working at a museum, the currency of culture is stories.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I mean, people will talk about time, they'll talk about money, but the one thing that you will see consistently is people will waste a tremendous amount of time and a tremendous amount of money chasing the story that they can tell or a story that can be told to them. Mm-hmm.
No, it's one of those things where even just like the value of a person, like someone can do great charity work. They can have great qualities. They can be a hard worker, but at the end of the day, they're forgettable unless you can tell a good story, unless you can play with them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Stories make things memorable, which goes back to that adjunct memory aspect in that human beings, as far as anybody can tell, human beings are the only ones that tell stories of the communicating animals.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You know, and so, I mean, human beings may, for the most part, really be the only ones that actively recognize the concept of a past. Mm.
That'd be interesting if that was the case. Yeah. What was it? This is a silly thing to bring up because I remember every now and then we'll see like some report on like people trying to teach animals.
Yeah.
And like we do it through language because there's no other way you can communicate any sense of tense. But it's like, hey, can we teach a gorilla or like a dog in the case that I was reading about yesterday? Can we teach them about the past tense? Can we teach them in a way that they will use the past tense?
Right.
Yeah. And like if we ever cross that bridge, then that's going to be huge because maybe then we just aren't as special as we like to think we are. But if they can't, then that means we are that special.
Right. Mm. Or even if we can't, but it's only doable with certain. So you know, it can only be done with primates, or you see it in primates and cetaceans, or humans and cetaceans, but not porpoises and primates.
Sure.
You know, then the one thing at the very least you've done is you've established a psychological level, and that is the ability for an individual to conceive of and relate past tense, communicating to other members of its culture or community.
Well, and that kind of goes into the whole, like what really makes humans so interesting is that we can perceive of the future of this abstract idea and we live for the abstract idea rather than for the present reality.
Right.
And that's where you get a whole bunch of like the more hippie movements, which is like, no, I live for the now. I live for the present.
Right.
But even the fact that we as humans, we struggle between living in an unreal world and the real world. That's a big deal.
It's a huge deal, especially a huge cognitive deal. Mm-hmm. Because if you assume that no other animal, even though it communicates, has a culture, you know, has a community with individuals that, you know, identify themselves as a pod or a part of a, you know, something. If they're not, I mean, they're seeing the world from their standpoint. We're seeing the world at any given point in time of what we currently have is immediate knowledge, what are we applying from past experience in an attempt to predict what the future is going to be like? So you have three different parts of your brains at the very of your brain at the very least establishing a personality that is attempting to process three different things and then come together
and to synergize that into
a singular piece. So it's not like, you know, two people with multiple personalities trying to talk to each other on a constant basis, you know, somehow it does. And that's one of the things I've been reading lately, I have epilepsy. And so, and so one of the big things that's coming out of epilepsy research now is personality research because epilepsy affects different portions of the brain. It doesn't just generate in one area of the brain.
Right.
Okay. And they've noticed that depending upon where epilepsy is in the brain, different personality traits.
Interesting.
And so, and that those different personality traits will swap based upon things like, are you about to have a seizure? Mm-hmm. Have you just had a seizure? You know, and so they're looking at this and then other things, because some of the aspects of brain surgeries that will fix epilepsy are also causing these weird personality perception issues.
Right.
So like, the most common aspect of fixing epilepsy is to section the two hemispheres of the brain.
And really
the two hemispheres they're finding, since language and writing occur in one and language occurs in one, writing occurs in the other. It's really funny it's always so hard to explain because it goes across and the part that gets me confused. But the idea is that what my right eye sees and is interpreted by the left side of my brain, I can write out. If my left eye sees the same thing, because my brain's, the two hemispheres are no longer communicating, that my right brain is seeing something, but because it cannot access the language center, I cannot tell you what I'm seeing.
Oh, that's weird.
From my left eye.
And so, like, hypothetically, if you were to block off one eye, something that was formerly intelligible is no longer.
No, it's intelligible. I just can't tell you about it.
Really?
I can draw it, though. And if I draw it, it'll be reversed and upside down.
Huh.
Because the human visual center. So,
right,
so it's interesting to see that, you know, the information we're getting is parsed through so many different things. And each of these are sections of the brain that, as far as that portion of the brain is aware, is the only portion of the brain that's there, that's conscious. So now it's one of the things that psychologists are putting forth is that nobody has a core personality. That any given moment, a human being is personality by consensus.
That's kind of interesting because I've heard how people change according to the behavioral environment that they're in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that can sometimes be really dramatic and really stark, especially if you're someone from like a third culture kid, effectively. Mm-hmm. Someone who is born from one culture, but they're living in a different culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're switching when they're in their different primary environments. And some people will even change how they speak, and then we get into code switching and all that kind of stuff.
Right. When you get, learning new languages. But no, one of the things you're like you're saying is that they're finding with the cross-cultural kids is that one culture, when they're operating in the personality of that culture and they're in that culture and their peers are in that culture, they will act as a completely different person.
Yeah.
They may be more angry, or they may be more happy. They may be more sad. They may have characteristics of being more extroverted versus introverted. And then you swap them over to a whole other culture and a whole other section is now processing of the brain is processing that. And you'll see their personality switch. They're seeing it in dementia and Alzheimer's patients as portions of the brain come offline.
Really?
You see their personalities switch.
Oh.
And so the question is, you know, how many people are there actually in our brain? How many of them are shouting over others?
I suppose that especially makes sense with like the Alzheimer's case, where you have people who regress and all of a sudden they are a very accurate representation of who they were exactly 26 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And so that's what I'm looking at it. And so you begin applying this to retail and to how groups are thinking, and it is being applied to group retail, especially. But it's really interesting to see in the concept right now among leadership and management of retail is the idea of creating store cultures. Mm. So that regardless of what your personality and culture may be outside of the store,
when you're in the store, you adopt part of the store's culture.
Yeah.
Oh,
what does that culture look like? Mm-hmm. You know, not just as a teamwork between staff, but how does that store then as a culture mm-hmm. relate to another store, to mm-hmm. the store next door, to, you know.
So like how does that take place in a retail location? Is it just like you play music, you paint the walls, you put up art?
That's the primary physical aspect. More and more now they're getting, at least in the bookselling industry, into and the bookselling industry, from what I've seen, is taking this from big retail industry. Mm. So like Target, you'll sit through a training portion of how to talk to a customer. Mm. Don't ask a customer how their day has been, because their day may be bad.
And you don't want to elicit
and you don't want
bad.
Them to realize that.
Gotcha.
Welcome to our store. Welcome to our culture. We're here to say, you know, literally find a statement. One of the things is in Ghana, the greeting, if you translate out the greeting of what we think of as hello in Ghana, not Ghanese, but whatever the language is, it translates out as, I see you.
Ah, okay.
The reply to that is, I see you too, and I'm making you real.
Ah.
So the first thing that people do in the Ghanese language, or, you know, in Ghana and that language group, is to acknowledge that they're both real people. Mm. You know, there may be any number of reasons for that, for ranging from, you know, the Vikings used to do something very similar because of ghosts. So, you know, you just didn't go around telling anybody your name immediately.
Okay.
You waited to make sure that they weren't a ghost. And you greeted them in certain fashions because a living person could greet you back in the right fashion. A ghost couldn't.
I did not know that. That's really funny.
Yeah, it doesn't exist much anymore.
Yeah. That would be a funny way to treat a client or a potential customer as they come in. It's like, hey, are you a ghost?
Are you a ghost?
You?
Ghost? Spirit? Human? Human.
Glad we got that cleared out of the way.
There could be multiple reasons, but today I think, you know, given just sort of the general background and ability that technology gives us to dehumanize people, the concept of somebody walking in the store and you literally saying to him, I recognize you as an equal human being, is almost, I mean, it's really stilted and is not something that, but I wouldn't be surprised if a level of practice or some methodology occurred over the next generation. Mm. As Americans or Westerners, or, you know, when they move into a public establishment or public area outside of a family circle or a church or, you know, a small sub-community circle out in their regular community.
And for that language to start being adopted,
mentality. Some form of that language or that concept being adopted, and that is, you're human, I'm human, hey, we're equal.
That's interesting because you really see that, I think, prominently in like the more progressive circles in our Western society, where a lot of the language is like, hey, I feel seen.
Yeah. Or,
I want you to know that I see you and I hear what you're saying. And again, like even down to the human element, it's like, hey, we're all just humans. It's really emphasizing that universal element. Mm-hmm. That is interesting.
Yeah. And so it's that empathy, that somehow finding a way to create an empathetic response and greeting. And of course, it is still business. And so retail is going to use that to create a dopamine reaction. Mm. So that when you walk in and you walk into a place that is empathetic to you, even if you are having a bad day, you know that you're coming in and they're going to let you have a bad day and it's going to be okay that you have a bad day. They're not going to ask you about it. They're going to let you be the one that comes forth as to what it is, but they're going to serve you as good as they've ever served you. They're going to have the best product that you've ever wanted. Mm-hmm. They're going to be there it's this weird when retail therapy, retailists, sellers are almost becoming a weird sort of therapist.
Yeah.
In a very small, very currently socially undefined way, but I see that way getting much more defined as a cultural mechanism.
So here's a thought, and let me know what you think of it. Because it seems to me that in spite of the fact that we thought that reading was too hard for women at a certain time in our history, women seem to be the largest demographic of fiction readers right now.
Yep.
Do you think that real conscious emphasis on like the empathetic, the really warm environments, do you think that's just especially valuable to books because perhaps that appeals more to the women buyer?
The old aspect of women are more empathetic than men.
Yes. Really? No. Okay. Walk me through that.
And the reason is that one of the things that I've been personally studying since it came out in the 1990s is what I call the Iron John movement.
Iron John.
It was Gen X getting rid of toxic masculinity.
Gotcha.
Okay. The problem is, first thing you got to do is be able to actually identify what toxic masculinity is and isn't.
Famously, a not controversial topic right now.
Right. hasn't been up for discussion for like three generations now at all. The reason it's called the Iron John movement was because there was a book written called Iron John. And it was about toxic masculinity and how to deal with it. Mm. So you'd go on, the masculine campouts where all the guys get, guys' nights out, where instead of getting, totally drunk and falling over and doing something stupid, you talked about your feelings and did that kind of stuff.
That sounds super fun.
See, even today, men are like, but that's based upon really old, really outdated Victorian concepts. Mm. It is not something which is, if it was truly a physiological or biological issue, you would see it across cultures. Mm. And you don't. You see men and women empathize differently across cultures, across history. Mm. The one thing it does seem to happen is that it does get split into gender roles for some reason. Mm. I think that's just something inherent in that concept of humanity as gender roles.
Again, could perhaps just be like for the sake of simplification for the understanding of reality.
Yeah. I don't know, but it just, we separate things out into gender roles and empathy and cultural communication is one of those. Yeah,
we identify that as more archetypically feminine for whatever reason.
Right. And So no, I don't think that's something as a piece that's the reason. I think the reason that women, because if you take a look, it's not that women read more than men. Mm. And it's not that they read more fiction than men do. Women are more likely to read mystery and romance. Mm. But I think that probably has to do more with what the gender role is. Mm. In that if you take a look at books, fiction books in general, if they have a male protagonist, that male protagonist is usually going to be somehow related to an aggressive role. Mm. Okay. Police officer, military, business,
not necessarily violent, but aggressive.
Aggressive.
Yes.
That aggressive, I've got to be out there role, an extroverted role. Mm. Okay. Whereas women are classically in books relegated to an introverted, non-aggressive piece, which is
just naturally more domestic for whatever reason.
Not domestic, more inclined to the behind the scenes work and the intuitiveness of it. So detectives.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Mystery figures, somebody who is not at the forefront of the whole thing, but is the one who is off to the side and seeing things from the feminine angle. Mm. The angle, I guess, thinking about male and female roles, gender roles, maybe that's one of the primary aspects that we're looking at, is that males take on more of the direct role, women, feminine-wise, culturally take on more indirect roles. Mm. Possibly because of child rearing. I don't know why. And it's purely supposition on my part.
Sure.
Just a flash of intuition. But... Yeah, so mystery writes to that. Mm-hmm. And even if you take a look at Stephen King, or horror or thrillers, the people in those compared to the people, the protagonists in a Stephen King book are not the protagonists, the same style of protagonist as you're going to find in a Clive Cussler book.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Even though they both may be dealing on some sort of international or even extra global level of something or other, they just aren't going to operate the same way. Stephen King's characters are going to operate in a much more indirect, subtle, intuitive fashion than Clive Cussler, who is going to be go out and get the information by God and solve the damn problem.
continuing with that mystery element, it's probably why Agatha Christie's always had such a prominently feminine audience.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And so women, just like men do, look generally towards their cultural role models. Mm-hmm. And mystery and romance, women are presented as the protagonists. And so I think women are just simply more likely to identify with that because the protagonists, even if they are men, are much more feminine from that standpoint of being more introverted in the process and more intuitive in the process of the storytelling.
Mm. So continuing on with a bit more of the business angle with that then, what do you find are the books that you guys are selling the most? Like what's becoming your bread and butter at your bookstore?
Oh, goodness gracious. Really, whatever the latest new author
really
is. Yes.
So like when Brandon Sanderson comes out with a new fantasy book.
We're going to sell a lot of Brandon's, and not just that new book, but a lot of his past stuff.
Oh, sure. That makes sense.
Book selling, at least so far, seems to operate a lot like movie. You know, it's your latest favorite author, director, actor, actress is coming out with a new movie. Mm. You're going to go see that. And then you're going to go back for nostalgia's sake to the other ones.
Right.
Or if it's new, latest in the series, you're going to go back and catch up because chances are it's come out well after the last of the series. Mm. You can't binge watch books, unfortunately.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the series Wheel of Time? I read those books. It took me a year. For those who don't know, Wheel of Time is like the longest fantasy series ever published.
27 in the series?
I think it's 14 books, but it's got like 27,000 named characters or something outrageous like that.
Wait, Wheel of Time, Robert Jordan, Wheel of Time, not Game of Thrones. Because Wheel of Time is, I think there's 27 books in the Wheel of Time series.
Maybe if you include some of the extra books.
Well, yeah, because I guess he wrote a lot of things that became series that spawned off of the same.
Oh.
So like a character would leave the main storyline, but still continue on.
Oh,
and then
interesting.
Pop in at later.
I definitely didn't read any of those.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No, because the main 13 or 16 books, whatever, because Brandon Sanderson had to finish them off. They were.
Yeah.
I did not find them to my taste, but I finished it because I was a masochist. They're so long. Like, they're the biggest books ever. And I knew a fella that read all of them in, like, 3 months over the course of a summer. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's outrageous. Why would you do that to yourself? That is the equivalent of, like, binge-watching the longest Netflix series every night. It's The Office, all 9 seasons, every week for a month or for a summer. That's insane to me.
Yeah.
I respect the people who can read that much in volume because that's genuinely impressive. That's a real skill.
Yeah. Well, but it's what people want.
Yeah.
It is what people want. I mean, it's Game of Thrones is again, you know, I got through this halfway through the second book. Mm-hmm. I just don't have the time to keep track of everybody.
I know. Like you have to have like an index over here.
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, and Tolkien did a great job of that, but he didn't, you know, that was all included in the annotated bits surrounding the primary story as opposed to, you know, folding everything in all at once. But again, people can't get enough of Game of Thrones.
Mm. Well, maybe they're kind of done with it now.
Oh, I don't know. All the people that I know that are Game of Thrones fans, they just want more. I mean, that's the one thing we're seeing. I've noticed with across all media, that franchise concept.
Yeah, it's just content.
It's just you love the universe and you want to see more things. I mean, it's where you love the universe more than the actual story.
Mm.
And it's one of the things that I really am glad that Tolkien's family never did.
Yeah,
because they have the ability to just let Middle Earth go and let people add to it. And people would do it ad nauseum.
Mm.
But it's like Star Wars is sort of get watered down. I mean, it's the one thing that...
Don't get me started on that. Don't even get me started.
You know, Star Trek. I mean, it's that franchise piece now in which it almost doesn't matter how good the story is, as long as it's told in that universe.
Yeah, it's there seemed to have been a time where, and I think like Lord of the Rings still has a lot of this, where it's that prestige to the name.
Yes.
And part of that kind of was, for better or for worse, from the lack of all that there was. It's like there was only three Lord of the Rings movies and three Lord of the Rings books for the longest time.
Right.
And then they had like some extra books that were all good, but they were for the hardcore fans. Now we're at that point where like Star Wars is coming out with a new show every 6 months.
Right. Exactly. It's sort of, it just sort of becomes the common.
Yeah. And it does, like, people want that content because they do love the world. But I like Star Wars is historically like people aren't caring the way that they used to anymore, which is such a shame because that was massive back when it first came out.
It was. But you know, the thing is, the one thing that they'll never experience though, is that nostalgia.
Yeah.
And that's the reason it's becoming more common. That's the other thing we're seeing in retail too, is nostalgia.
Really?
Oh yeah. The gift items are just, it's nostalgia sells. So like we just last summer started carrying, and I don't know if you recognize, blackjack, gum. What were the other? It was an old bunch of gum from the 1970s.
Really?
Yeah. Big red, blackjack, wintergreen, and they were super popular back then. And then they like died out in the late 90s because people started getting dentures and they couldn't chew gum anymore. They just stopped chewing gum because they didn't like it. But right. You know, your childhood favorites you weren't doing anymore.
But now someone brought them back.
Someone brought them back.
Oh.
And so we've got this, our display of old gums that people will come in, and people who are my age or older will go, oh, I remember that gum. And they'll buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they want to know if their youth still tastes the same.
Right. And like that's always going to have a certain amount of selling power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And that's where you take a look at some of that piece that we're talking about, with nostalgia being the, you know, a driver for franchises, in that for us, it's nostalgia. I mean, the one thing I will always remember about Star Wars are the first three movie screenings of Star Wars and going and sitting at those and being so excited. I mean, you know, as opposed to, you know, hey, there's a new Andor coming out, and Andor was a really good show, and I'm looking forward to season two, but I am not looking forward to it the same way I was looking towards Empire of the Strikes Back.
No, I remember, because like I grew up in that time where I was just flooded with Star Wars stuff because the prequels were just coming out and kids had everything that they ever wanted. And then I still remember that, like, I remember the day I proposed. I remember my marriage. I remember the birth of my child. I remember the day Disney bought Lucasfilm, because I knew that day I was going to get another Star Wars movie. And like, it is weird because it's just oddly salient. And up until that point, every day I would check the news for Star Wars news. And when it came out, it was the best day of my life.
Yeah.
Until I got married. Until I got married.
And had your child.
And had my child. But no, it's, I think like books really are the first step to like the super big phenomenons. Cause like you look at the Hunger Games, you look at Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I bet in 10, 20 years, when they finally start actually adapting Brandon Sanderson stuff, he's going to dominate the market.
Right.
Yeah.
What's going to be interesting is, let's see, about 15 years from now, if the franchise models are proving correct, they're going to reboot Harry Potter.
I think they're already trying to make a show for it.
Are they trying to? Somehow they're going to try and take the original experience.
And they're just going to recreate it.
And recreate it.
Yeah.
For a whole new generation, which is, you know, and that becomes that weird nostalgia.
We're like, we have to make it every 20, every 15 years.
Yeah. It's like, it's a weird cultural stutter that we're beginning to have.
Yeah. And then eventually that's probably going to get so fragmented where all of a sudden we're going to have the new ones at the same time as the old ones.
Yeah. Cause you'll be able to access them, you know, via whatever media outlet source you've got. So
I know it's like, it got into the culture wars a little bit, but cause they're casting for the new Harry Potter show and they're getting some big names for some of the big actors. And I guess they let release who they're eyeing for Severus Snape, you know, fan favorite character. He's a black fella.
Oh, and so of course.
And so of course, like, I don't know if they do that because like of a DEI initiative, because he's the best actor, just because they want the news. But like, I guess
it's probably all of those.
Probably all three. Yeah, really. Oh my gosh. Anyways, I think we have covered so much over our conversations. Troy, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
These have been really, really fun. If you guys want to find Troy, where can they do so?
Well, you can find me down at the Linden Village Books and Paper Dreams at the inn at the Linden and the Waples Building, right there on the corner of 5th and Front. Of course, you'll find me. But you'll also find a tremendous number of really cool books.
Those are good gifts. Too. Yeah. And you guys can tell Troy all about your favorite hot alt history takes, and I'm sure he'll have a response for each of them.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Even if I, you know, have to do it just because I want to argue.
Well, Troy, thank you for joining me, and thank you guys for joining for this episode of A Businessman's Guide to Almost Everything. Until next time, take care and be well. Bye-bye.